God's love can be hard to swallow.
Yeah, no, it's hard as a dinner plate.
Kiev was...
Yeah, I know. Listen, man, it was 8 months ago. Gotta get back on the horse again. Your team back together again, two musketeers.
Doesn't feel wrong. They're bad people. They should suffer.
This is not fair.
I'll show you enough.
Yeah.
What's that, Adrian?
Daddy's showing off.
Does he know who you are? And doesn't, does he? I just want to say thank you. Not good at to have met you.
There's too many off my dog to fuck this.
Kill List, directed by Ben Wheatley. It's a 2011 British horror film. British horror, crime, melodrama mashup. Starts out, we have a very, very bad dinner date between a married couple and the one guy, Jay, our lead, his best friend, Gal. And the dinner date goes horribly. Then we find out they go to sneak a smoke in the garage, and then they start unloading machine guns, and we realize that these two guys are hitmen who are kind of doing it's been a while between jobs. The last job that they did went horribly wrong, and they're gonna kill three people for an unnamed source. And this, in the journey to kill these three people, they are going to have a basically mind-wrecking, career-wrecking run-in with what may or may not be their own psyches, and what may or may not be a overarching giant web of conspiracy and satanic cult activity in Britain.
That was Adam Caesar talking about Ben Wheatley's 2011 Nerve Shredder, Kill List. Mr. Caesar is an author who's penned such novels as Video Night, The Summer Job, Exponential, Zero Lives Remaining, and The Con Season, as well as the short story collection All Night Terror, written with Matt Serafini. In addition, Mr. Caesar wrote the 2012 novel Tribesmen, which is like a great novelization of the best damn Italian cannibal movie you've never seen. Mr. Caesar, thanks so much for being on the show.
Hey, Jinx, thanks for having me. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it. So I got to say, we've had a lot of folks on, and for the most part, they tend to pick older films to discuss, you know, classics or great films that they perhaps grew up with. So I got to ask, out of all the horror movies you might have gone with, why did you choose Kill List?
I did that semi-deliberately because I have been listening to the show, and I love the show, and I love the conceit of, you know, horror professionals choosing horror movies they love or that have influenced them. But I always, as someone who writes newer horror and someone who enjoys newer horror, I feel like I always run into that, you know, that con curmudgeon that comes up to the table and is like, you know, they don't make them like they used to, or, horror is dead, or like horror is all this, horror is that these days. And they have this kind of set idea of what modern horror is. And I think a film like Kill List, which in my opinion is a great film, kind of disproves a lot of the naysaying that goes on in horror culture. And, you know, I know there are some people that maybe take issue with it, so I'm going to hopefully try to convince them. You get more flies with honey. I'm going to hopefully, in our conversation, try to convince them that Kill List, Ben Wheatley's second feature film, is a great film.
It really is. And I got to say, before we dive into the conversation, we will inevitably have to get into spoilers. So any listeners out there who are on the fence about seeing this movie who haven't yet, just please take our word for it. Go watch the movie. In fact, stop the conversation right now. Go watch it and then come back, because honestly, the only way we're going to be able to talk about it is by discussing the ending. But if you haven't seen the movie, you're not going to want to have it spoiled for you.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just to reiterate, it's on Netflix, I think. It was at one point. It's definitely on Shudder. It's one of those things where it's like kind of a magic trick of a movie. So if you go into it unspoiled, if you go into it, the best way to go into it is like not even knowing really what genre it is. And that's part of what makes this movie such a great movie, is this weird three-act structure where it feels like three different movies that have kind of been scotch taped together at the act breaks. That's part of that brilliance of it, I think.
It's three different films in one without being an anthology and sharing the same characters. I mean, it's bizarre. It starts out like, it's one part domestic drama, then it turns into a crime or hitman flick, and then that final act, it turns into pure horror.
Yeah, and it turns into pure folk horror, which I feel is like a very, very British kind of horror. And I think Ben Wheatley, probably more than any other director working today, is such a British director. And people say that he's – not that we want to talk too much about his other films, but
we can digress all we want.
People keep saying that he like makes different, very different movies, like, and he's always working in different genres. And that is true, but I think there's this kind of DNA strand of Britishness and British kind of cultural comment in each one of his films very strongly. I think absolutely. That's kind of what connects them.
If you compare Kill List to his following movie, which was Sightseers, I mean, Sightseers, there is some violence and it is dark at times, but for the most part, like, it's a very dark comedy. And Kill List is most certainly not that. And yet you look at those two movies and it's clearly made by the same guy. And unfortunately, I own A Field in England, but I haven't gotten around to watching it. I've seen the trailers, and same thing with High Rise. I'm a bad fan. I need to watch his.
Oh, you are. Yeah, no. And they all kind of play and build off of each other, because A Field in England is, I mean, it is back in time, but it's just basically like, let's make a Samuel Beckett play. Let's make an absurdist play that takes place basically in one field with these kind of constant collaborators. I mean, Michael Smiley's in it. He's like the lead antagonist. It continues that theme of where do we come from as a people? Like, what do we value as a people? I like all his films. High Rise does too, but High Rise, the problem in my mind as such a big Ben Wheatley fan is that it's almost too good an adaptation of the J.G. Ballard novel. It feels like the themes are Ballard's themes, which is good. As a film on its own, it's good. But as me as a fanboy trying to kind of like make it mesh with the rest of his back catalog, it kind of throws a curveball in there because it's just so different. And I'm sure his new one, Free Fire, is going to be a very different kind of thing on its own, has got the biggest stars in it. I'm sure that's going to throw another monkey wrench in that kind of reading of his films. But yeah, I'm just a huge fan of his. I'm a huge fan of all his kind of constant collaborators. His wife, Amy Jump, who co-writes most of his films, who co-wrote Kill List, and his cinematographer, Laurie Rose, I think does wonderful work here.
Yeah, it's such a beautifully shot film. I mean, I think at times the movie is sort of, and I'm not knocking it. I don't really want to say anything negative about the movie or put people off from watching it if they haven't yet, and they should have tuned out by now.
Yeah, I think
watch
now
the
we can
film and then come back. But yeah, I do think that the digital photography, in 2011 when they were shooting this, it does occasionally, the look is sometimes marred a bit by that, especially when there's any sort of action or when the guns are firing. There's a bit of kind of image wobble that makes the movie look a little cheap at times, which is a shame because, if you look at the compositions and how the movie is shot and how it's cut, like, it's a very well-made, very well-designed movie. So, I try and imagine what the movie would look like, say, shot on 35 or something like that. And would it be significantly different? Probably not. And yet, I kind of wish it were, too. And yet, at the same time, it's that very digital look and that very sort of like indie film look that draws us into the movie in the first third when it is just a domestic drama. It feels almost like a mumblecore flick.
It's got that, it's got that kind of, it's got that kind of, oh, Jesus Christ, Dogma 95.
Oh, the Dogma 95, yeah, the Lars von Trier look.
Yeah, it's got that kind of von Trier fly on the wall feel to it. And I would turn that around and say that video-ness kind of works thematically, because this is a movie that is very much mired in the past, especially when you get to the horror elements. There's Blood on Satan's Claw and Wicker Man and Race with the Devil, kind of visual allusions to all these films that are in the 70s, but we do have that dissonance of this is a modern film. This is very, these are very modern problems. And we even have characters like Jay, for instance. Like, the thing that turns bad at the dinner table originally is he was in the army, he was in a war, but he was in the Iraq war. And his view is basically like that war was shit. I think those are his words. And like the idea that he would have loved to get a crack at the Nazis, which is kind of like, you know, I think his father's and Gal's father's kind of version of, you know, British masculinity, or Gal says, because Gal is, you know, a good Catholic, good Irish Catholic boy. Gal says, like, you know, get a crack at, you know, the Irish or the Nazis. It's the idea that these are men maybe a little bit out of time, even if they are kind of like a little bit slobs and a little bit not the world's best hitmen. They're kind of pining for that. They're kind of pining for that return to the olden days. And then when they get to go back in time and go back to the olden days, they go kind of too far to like Britain's pagan roots. And I can see kind of both characters being like, you know what, too far.
You know, it is curious too, when we think about Jay, I mean, he's a guy who is, you know, he has a knack for violence, and he seems to, I don't know if he enjoys it, but he certainly throws himself into it with a sort of relish, you know, which is weird considering that when the movie opens, he's a guy who's balking from, you know, providing for his family by taking jobs.
He doesn't want to go back to work, and work for him is killing people. Like, so yeah. he's kind of the dude who's like okay to sit on the couch and doesn't really want to go back out and get a job. But it's not until, I think, you know, 17 minutes into the movie, because I watched it last night and I took notes. So I've got the act breaks like kind of noted out. And we should say that Jay is played by Neil Maskell, and it's a great performance. And it's one of those things like he doesn't want to go back to work. But once he starts working, once he kind of makes his first kill, once he kills the priest and they start stuffing him in the incinerator, you can kind of see this reawakening. And it's almost like the idea that he's more into this than Gal ever is. And even if Gal is a slightly more professional guy, his buddy, and there is this kind of bromance at the center between Neil Maskell and Michael Smiley's character. You know, it's a very good bromance in the traditional sense. It's like this homosocial, like guys that have been through a lot together, guys who like, you know each other's significant others, know each other's, you know, Gal's not married, but he's like kind of this forever bachelor, and he gets along well with Jay's kids. He gets along well with Jay's wife, maybe a little too well, and it makes Jay jealous.
And there's a great story to be told there that isn't, but I would love to know more about that relationship, you know?
Yeah, you never, I'm trying to think back on it. How many scenes do we get of just Gal and Shell, the wife, together? Not many. I don't think they're ever maybe in the same room together, because you get Gal and son.
I think it's maybe just one scene. There is a moment where, you know, Jay has just left, and, you know.
Oh, it's after that. Yeah, it's after once he turns over his lamb chops. Yeah. What does he say? I'm finished. And he just turns it. Oh, it's so good. I love that whole scene.
Yeah, it's so great. But, you know, it is funny, and I wonder what kept Jay from working. I doubt it. It's mere laziness. Like, you get the sense that he's a very reluctant killer. Like, something happened on that Kiev job, which is never really fully illuminated for the audience. We know that they were
not
on a job,
all.
And something went terribly wrong.
And, it feels like the filmmakers didn't know. Like, I'm cool with that. This is a movie that has a ton of exposition, but you don't get to hear any of it. And I love that. It's such a ballsy move.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, one wonders if, you know, the Kiev job that goes wrong, like, not only does that seem to have broken Jay for a time anyway, but it also, you know, arguably is the reason that the organization that employs he and Gall later on, like, was that the, was that the test run?
We don't know if that's like a trial run, or like if that was like, oh, you aced your audition in Kiev, you know, like, and it could be, but it could just be one of those like, hey, they needed some guys. Like, but it does seem like towards the end of the movie that Jay is somehow more important. Jay does have some kind of, they're after Jay for some reason. He is kind of this perfect arbiter for them of some kind of idea.
Yeah, for whatever reason, too, that's yet another thing that isn't fully spelled out, which I kind of love. But, you know, by that point, the movie is in full horror territory. And again, when it opens, I mean, you know, it is, it's kind of a domestic drama. It's you know, there's a dinner date with friends. But even from the start, we can sort of tell that there's something amiss, you know, like when Gall shows up and brings a dinner date, like, you know, the fact that they have Fiona very early on carving that strange symbol, which opens the movie, onto the back of their mirror in their bathroom. We know that clearly we've shown up to watch a horror movie, but then we're almost sucker punched with this, you know, this sort of mumblecore-y drama in a way, yeah, about a
that's
guy who doesn't
like
want to
20 minutes into the movie. I mean,
yeah, true.
Like that's the first quote unquote, like genre thing that happens. And that's not until 20 minutes in, you know, like, and at that point we think we're in a crime movie cause we see them with guns. Like, or is that, am I mixing it up? Does Fiona carve the thing first?
You know, I can't, oh my God, I just watched it last
night. I'm pretty
sure we
see
them, carves it after,
like going through the guns first, and then we see her in the bathroom.
Could be.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I should know that, but yeah, the, you know, and so we know that something's off to begin with almost, but you know, not only because of the symbol carving, but you know, there are all these jump cuts and sort of tonal changes that constantly keep us off balance. You know, that we go from laughter to fighting and from a humorous moment to something that's sort of romantic and touching. And we're like emotionally ping pong throughout the early part of the film.
Yeah. It runs you around even before anything violent happens. Like I think it's just like that kind of dread, and that since we're so strong a POV in Jay's head, you got to imagine, like, you see him trying to, like, button his shirt, and he's, like, his hands are shaking. Like, you got to imagine maybe that's partly just how he sees the world. Even just very benign things, even, like, you know, a dinner date can become kind of a war zone for him.
Oh, sure. Even when things calm down, you know, after he's had his blow up and after they have their fight and, you know, Gall tucks, you know, Sam, the child, back in the bed and, you know, everything's calmed down and then they're drinking and laughing and dancing. You get the feeling that, okay, you know, this was a powder keg and it's blown, but everything's cool now and everybody's friends again and everything's all right. And then Gall and Fiona leave. And the first thing that Jay says is, thank fuck that's over.
Yeah.
And there's
that
look on Shell's face like, oh my God, the last hour, you know, who knows how long it was, you know, the dancing and the laughing and the finally having fun at a party. But, you know, there's that look on her face like she realizes that it was a lie in a way, you know, that there's something deeply wrong with him.
But there's something wrong with that. But I feel like there's something, I don't know, maybe this makes me a bad person, but I can like sympathize with that. I like even the idea that he's such a guy, he's this kind of guy that even when he's being social, he doesn't want to be social. Like even when he's being social, it's a little bit of an act. And we see glimmers of, I feel like, the true Jay only when he's doing heinous things and being kind of rewarded for them.
And yet, you know, I agree with you and I think you're right. But it's weird to think that, you know, it's kind of tough to reconcile that, too, with the Jay that we see around his son. You know, when he and his wife and his son are fighting with foam swords, or he's telling his wife he's going to cook up the rabbit and she's like, not in my kitchen. And then the next thing we see, he's frying
he
up the rabbit.
Yeah.
And then he's sitting out in the yard and he's got that big shit eating grin on his face as he's eating it. And, you know, she's telling her son that, you know, he's just showing off. I mean, he is, I think there's part of him that's probably, I think there's a part of him that wants to be like a 1950s television dad. Like,
but
I think he wants to be.
It's all very performative and it's all very like his way or the highway. Because, like, those are, like, you know, playing sword fighting, I feel like, is something that Jay would do, you know, it's, you know, performing being a dad. And when he's telling the kid the bedtime story, it's, like, the kid wants to hear something different. And he's, like, telling him about, like, roadside bombings in Iran. Like, the kid's, like, tell me about King Arthur, which is, you know, to weave back to our, like, thematics, this is, like, a very classical British thing, you know, an invented history, an invented mythical king. Like, tell me about King Arthur. And he's like, no, no, no. I'm going to tell you about, like, you know, horrific war stories.
Oh, totally. And, you know, we at some point, maybe not right now, but at some point we need to come back to the foam sword fighting. And it's
oh, yeah. Yeah. It's almost like when you watch the movie a second time, it's almost Gilding the Lily. It's almost a little too much for me. And this is a movie that I absolutely love. So I wouldn't say that lightly, but it comes close.
It
especially because it's
right over
down.
My head.
It was the slow motion.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, that's a good point. Yeah, when I first saw the movie, did not call back to that at all. Did not think about that moment. Didn't think it had any importance. I didn't even remember it. And I think after I watched it, I immediately showed it to a friend. And as soon as that moment came up, it was like a lightning bolt. I was like, oh, my God. That's awful. But we'll get to that. We'll get to that at some point. But, yeah, so, you know, the movie opens with sort of this this dinner party, and then we eventually discover that something is amiss on Fiona's end when she carves that weird symbol into the mirror. And then we discover that, you know, Jay and Gall, you know, in the same section are hitmen. And then we sort of transition into a full on like crime flick, you know, like these two assassins taking a job. And the movie has that sort of tonal shift, and yet it completely works. The movie still feels of a piece, you know, like when we get to that point. And even though, you know, the first thing that we see when they meet their would-be employer, he cuts Jay's hand open to seal the contract.
He reaches for him, and Gal's like, you know, his squad's got his back. Gal pulls the gun on him immediately. Like,
yeah, and that's a great moment, too. It's like, but you know what's crazy is that he laughs. Like, Jay just, you know, he calls Gal off, and, you know, he... Once it's done, he sort of laughs and he's like, well, fuck, that was dramatic. I'm bleeding all over the carpet. And he walks away. Why is it that he doesn't beat that guy's head in? Like, everything that we know about Jay is that he has a very short fuse. He's a hot-tempered guy, but he's the one who finds that moment kind of humorous.
But I don't know. This is, I mean, I'm on the fly here, but it's also the idea that Jay, with his military background, is maybe used to kind of taking hits from employers. And once this guy has switched over into employer territory, he becomes kind of untouchable.
That makes sense.
Or the idea of him being like a kind of like a very clearly working class guy. And this goes to the doctor scene too, where like, if your doctor talked to you, like the doctor that Jay gets talked to you, you'd be like, I want a second opinion. And he kind of just, you know, like, you know what I mean? Like, he kind of just listens to the weird philosophy the doctor tells him, like, without much question, without much pushback. Like,
yeah, I agree. But I wonder if part of it, too, might be the fact that Jay enjoys violence, even when it's done to him. You know?
I didn't even think of that. Yeah. No,
when he tells his son a story, like he doesn't tell him a bedtime story. You know, he tells him a violent story. When he plays with his son, he plays at killing him. When he finally takes a job, you know, I mean, words seem to infuriate Jay. You know, the notion that he's not earning for his family infuriates Jay, and he will scream and yell and stomp and throw things. But the fact that his hand was cut open and the only thing he can think to do is sort of giggle about it and make a joke, I think there's a part of him that it just he gets off on any sort of violence, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
And unless it's done to other people in a really heinous way. And one can only imagine, you know, okay, I'm jumping ahead here. But I mean, okay, so eventually they get their kill list and they start finding these people. They kill a priest.
Yes.
And then the second person is called the librarian.
Which they justify by saying he's probably a molester.
Yeah. Yeah, which is...
And that,
you know,
that makes it so much easier, and that makes that kind of joy center buzz for Jay.
Oh, totally. And he... Yeah. You know, the notion that this guy has done any sort of violence against children, I mean, I think it makes it all the easier for him to pull the trigger. But, you know, the second guy, you know, we never see what's on the tapes. We never see what's on the second guy's, the librarian's tapes. But we hear...
Yeah, he's just
am
the
I
librarian.
Wrong in thinking that we hear, like... children screaming, because that's how I heard it, you know, on those
what's
tapes.
Funny
like,
is when I watched it this time, I watch it with the captions on.
Uh-huh.
And the captions just say woman screaming, but I feel like when I listen to it, it sounds someone much younger than a woman. It sounds like a kid.
Same. And I think that's the line that cannot be crossed for Jay. Like, that's what infuriates that guy.
Or
like,
is it something that, you know, because he's so disconnected from society but can kind of look at society on the way, you know, be like kind of an outsider looking in, he realizes that is like the ultimate taboo and the rules of society have been broken. So he gets to go on his second ultimate taboo killing spree with carte blanche. You know, they kill the librarian and then they kill those two other dudes in the warehouse who presumably aren't on their list. Because they get the names of them from the library, or they get the address from the librarian.
Very true. But I I do like the idea that it's, you know, there is, it has to be children that sets Jay off. But not only because he has a son, but I think it makes the, and we haven't gotten to super spoilery territory yet, so I'll dance around it. We haven't gotten to that point in the story, but it makes the final minute even harder to take in a way, yeah. knowing that that's what that means to him. Like, does that make
especially
any sense?
Especially because the son takes the brunt of the violence there.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, God.
The hump. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. But, you know, it's funny going back to the first name on the list, you know, they kill a priest and, you know, they justify it by saying, yeah, he's probably, you know, like they suggest that he might be, you know, a molester. But there is that weird sort of thing with Jay and religion. You know, not only is he all too happy to kill a priest, but early on when he and Gall are hanging out in the, you know, the hotel's restaurant, there's a Christian band sort of like strumming away, and he gets angry. And, you know, I mean, the simplest reading might simply be that he's an edgy guy and these guys were sort of intruding on his space with their noise, you know, their music. But another part of me wonders if it's not the Christianity that offends him most.
I think it definitely is. And I think what's interesting is that Gall is a Christian or is religious to a certain extent. And you know, he does that kind of Animal House, the Bluto moment where he basically takes away the guy's guitar and tells him like, Jimi Hendrix, you ain't. And the guy's response is, and I wrote this one down cause I wanted to talk about religion in the movie. Sometimes God's love can be hard to swallow. And then Jay's response to that, not as hard as a dinner plate, which is a great tough guy response.
Oh, it even cuts to Gall, and he can't help but giggle at that, even though you get the feeling he's probably embarrassed by what his friend's doing, but he couldn't help but laugh himself.
Oh, yeah,
at that
and
line.
He definitely does. I mean, he even apologizes for Jay at the end, and he says, put in a good word for us. That's kind of, you know, you see Gall cross himself when they go into the church. When they go into the priest's office, he crosses himself. Gall said, put in the good word for us there. I feel like there's one more kind of signifier of Gall's religion that I'm forgetting. But it's definite that like that religion sets Jay off and maybe Gall finds solace in it. And maybe it's one of those things that they just don't talk about because clearly their friendship can come to blows at any moment.
Oh, totally. I mean, there's
heard
that
about each other, like, you know, through years and years of being together.
Oh, yeah, almost certainly. And yeah, you get the feeling that they probably made their peace with whatever their differences are. I mean, my God, you have that knockdown, drag out fight between them in the, you know, near the end of the second act where they, you know, they're breaking things over each other's heads. And, you know, they look like they're trying to strangle each other to death. And then it does, you know, that great jump cut to them sitting on the couch.
Yeah, they just
drinking a beer together.
Beers. Yeah, yeah.
Which is so great. And it tells you so much about those guys and, you know, what their time together has probably been like. And, you know, even the fact that, like, it goes from Gall slapping Jay in the face to Jay breaking a cup over his head.
Yeah,
to
and it's,
a
not,
second
even, it's
later.
Not even a bad a slap as Shell gave him, like, no. Just minutes earlier. Like, it's nowhere near as bad, but he just breaks a cup over his head.
But as soon as he gets knocked down and Gall has the upper hand, the first thing that he says is, not the face!
Yeah,
it's like are you really trying to dictate terms at this point? Like when you've ratcheted up the violence here so much, but yeah. But at the same time, it's such a fun friendship. It's such a fun relationship to watch in the movie. Those two guys, and I almost wish. Yeah, I don't really, but I wouldn't at all mind if there were prequels about those two guys just on the job.
Oh, yeah, I
want
to see Kiev. Yeah.
Oh, totally. Give me the Kiev prequel. You know.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, but you know, okay, but by this point, you know, they've started taking out people on the list. And I got to ask, what's your opinion on the, you know, the movie opens on black and you see that the cult symbol scratched in the place. And then from that point on, every time they go after a member or a character on the a person rather on the kill list, as it were, we get the big white titles that hit the screen.
Yeah, you get a title card for each one of them. It's not even – they don't really correspond to act breaks. They just kind of correspond with them about to meet or see
totally.
The person in some way. Yeah,
I
don't know.
I usually don't like brushstrokes like that in a straight horror film. You know, it calls attention to itself. It screams, you're watching a movie, you know, when that's the last thing you should be thinking of. But for whatever reason, it works in this film.
I love them. Yeah, I don't know why. I can't even articulate it. Like, it's really hard because I never wrote a review for Kill List. I've mentioned it. I've put it on a few like top 10 lists. Like I mentioned it on like Cemetery Dance and stuff in my column there. But I've never actually sat down to write about it. And I feel like it's one of those things where it's so much easier to talk about something that you like with asterisks. Like it's so much easier to talk about something that you like, you know, that has to be qualified than something you kind of, not unconditionally, but something that you're just head over heels over. Like it's a harder film for me to like kind of pick apart because like, I don't even really know. And like you said, those are not subtle things. Like to have the priest, the librarian,
we have the MP and then we have the hunchback. And, you know, again, like that stuff usually takes me out of a movie, but in this case, those words, when they hit the screen, you know, they have a bit more power than just because we know what's going to follow that. You know, we know that somebody's going to die when we see those words. And I think that's probably the reason they work in this film for me anyway.
And I think the repetition of it, I think it helps sell the ending better because you have, they keep saying three. They say there's three names on the list. They say, are you going to do the last one? So you're expecting it to kind of abide by those kind of, you know, like, you know, comedy or drama rules of three. And then you add a fourth one and you're kind of like, wait, who the hell is the hunchback? Especially the fact that you don't see Shell get knocked out. The last thing you see Shell do is drop five dudes with a silenced pistol. Like you're like, well, Shell's fine. So the idea that you have that, you know, you have that cut to the hunchback and then you have them putting, you know, putting the mask on them, getting them ready to fight. It just throws you off. I think it helps sell the ending a little better, which
and
is
the
not
hunchback
an ending,
is a
I think
terrifying
it's incredibly
figure.
Surprising. Yeah. It's not an ending that I feel like is terribly, you know, surprising. Like it is shocking. And I think their reactions more so, especially when you take the sheet off and Shell kind of laughs. I think it's the horror of like this, you can't take this back rather than the horror of, you know, leading the cop to the Wicker Man and setting it on fire. Like, oh, he was the sacrifice the whole time. It's less one of those things that's planted and paid off than one of those things that, oh, this is surprising, but it maybe in retrospect seems inevitable. And I think that's the ending walks that line really well for me, at least.
Yeah. And it is, you know, that's, you mentioned Shell laughing and, you know, when you look back at the movie, you realize that there were so many people guiding whatever this is, whatever's happening to Jay, whatever he's being positioned as and all the things he had to do to get there. We realize there have been people guiding him the entire way, not just his employer, not just Fiona, but also the doctor. And, you know, you see this entire cult and you got to imagine that they played a part, you know, maybe even going back to Kiev. But, you know, it's kind of a shock early on, I think, when we find out that Shell completely knows and participates in to a degree what her husband does. She knows
his job. Yeah. Yeah.
She wants him to be a hitman. She wants him to be a killer. You know, she wants him to provide for his family. And that's kind of shocking. That's not the thing that you would expect out of a movie like this, where, you know, the assassin with the heart of gold has a significant other that they keep their dangerous life from, you know, like she is completely committed to a guy that she knows is a murderer for hire.
Yeah.
But when we get to the end and the hunchback is revealed to be Shell and Sam, Jay's boy, you know, sort of lashed together, which, you know, we were talking about the foam sword fighting earlier when when Jay is fighting Shell and Sam and they're positioned in much the same way. Sam is on Shell's back and he's hacking away at them with a foam sword. Much the same happens at the end when he is attacking the hunchback and stabbing it to death. But for Shell to laugh as her son is dead on her back and she's spitting up blood and grinning, really. I mean, she seems happy. Do you feel as though she had a hand in whatever the cult was doing too, that she was guiding Jay much in the same way that everyone else was?
I don't think so. And I remember, and I didn't come to that conclusion until watching it a second time. And then, and I completely cheated. I looked at my answers a little bit. Not that you know, Amy Jump and Ben Wheatley are the, you know, unimpeachable sources, even though they made the movie, even though it's their movie, you can kind of still bring your own interpretation to it. Oh, but sure. Like last night, again, so skipping forward, the second time I watched it, I felt like the idea of her smile isn't malicious, isn't like you fell into our trap. Like I kind of read it the first time. It's more like, can you believe this shit? It seems so surprised, especially when colored by the context of we knew she was in the army from the, you know, from the very first part of the movie. But we didn't know what a kind of stone cold badass she was, you know, La Femme Nikita dropping people left and right until the end of the movie. And I feel like it's got that kind of, it has that kind of like warrior's disbelief of like losing a game almost.
I agree that it's, I never thought it was malicious. Like I never thought it was like a mustache twirling, ha, got you sort of moment, you know, but you know, I can sort of, can you imagine sort of a parallel being drawn between her reaction and the reaction of the priest who says, thank you, before he catches a bullet in the back of his head, or, you know, the guy who's had his kneecap and his hand hammered and just before he catches the hammer to the head, he's saying, thank you. He lays it down.
Yeah.
And so I felt the same way about Shell.
It's one of those things. It's like, it's such an interesting, it's such a good reaction. It's such a good performance because you can read a lot of different things into it. And I feel like it's a Rorschach test. I feel like I see something different every time. But last night when I watched it, I had switched on the commentary and Wheatley basically said like, oh, a lot of people read this as like, she's in on it, but that's not what we meant. Like,
cheater.
But I'm not, like I said, he's definitely not unimpeachable. Definitely not, you know, definitely not. It has to be kind of his way or the highway. Because there are so many other myriad factors in there, but it's part of what I love about the movie, that last little bit of confusion thrown in by not only her reaction, but Jay's looking down reaction, kind of this weird, you know, man, baby, boy, king with his hat on, with his straw, you know, crown on.
God, I never thought about that before, but you're right. He looks 12 when
he looks like a little kid playing dress up, I feel like. And, you know, all these people who are so obviously not kids kind of, who are all older than him being like, you know, you made it, you did it. Like, I don't know. It's a lot to chew on in, you know, 30 seconds of film footage.
It's funny. I guess I've always had the opinion that I thought that she was in some way in on it. But something that I'd never considered before rewatching it again last night was the moment early on after she and Jay have had their big fight about him not working. And, you know, there is that scene where she's in the bedroom and she's crying and she's talking on the phone in Swedish. And I had always read it as she's complaining to, say, her mother or her parents or somebody, girlfriend or who knows, about the sort of dire financial straits they're in, you know. But another part of me wonders if it's not like, if somebody would agree with me on the reading that she is in on it, like, imagine that bomb getting dropped. It's like, oh, by the way, for this to come to fruition, you and your kid need to die, you know. Like, you know, and I wonder what that would do to somebody. And I wonder, like, it seemed like there was something weirdly conspiratorial about that phone call, too, rather than it just being somebody complaining about their husband, you know?
Man, now I gotta go back and look at that scene again, because, like, you're opening up whole new doors of possibility for me to go down this rabbit hole with this movie. And I love that. That's part of what I love about this movie, is that it's worth noting, you know, 95 minutes, a clean, economical little movie that has a lot of character work, that has a lot of action, has a lot of stuff happening in it, but it's just, I don't know, there's something to be said about movies under 2 hours that get this much done.
Absolutely. It's so efficient in its way. Yeah. You know, it's such deft storytelling. I love it. And, you know, and by this point, you know, in the third act, we have fully descended into it being a horror movie, and not just like using horror movie tropes, but I mean, Wheatley goes full out in trying to terrify the audience at this point, you know?
Yeah. The whole tunnel sequence is great.
Oh my God.
And it's great when in a kind of like shower scene from Psycho kind of way, where if you watch it again, you don't see a whole lot. There's no hammer scene. Like the kind of biggest gore insert is when Gal's getting stabbed and the mask blowing apart, which doesn't even really have like blood behind it really that you can see. It's just you know, one of the cultists takes a headshot, and like, you know, we kind of pull the mask apart from behind. It's great.
No, I love it. And, you know, I got to admit, I'm a jaded horror movie fan. Like, not a lot gets to me, but there is one type of horror movie villain that gets under my skin more than any other, and that's friggin' cults, man.
Yeah.
Like, you show me The Wicker Man, and I'm a shivering mess by the end of it, except the remake, at which point I'm just laughing. But, you know, or show me Race with the Devil. Race with the Devil is a friggin' nightmare of a movie. And, yeah. You know, even something like, I mean, they're not a cult, but I don't know. Have you kept up with The Walking Dead?
I haven't. No, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I mean, I'm sure you're aware of, like, who Negan is. I mean, that's kind of
I mean, we're recording this right when the new season came out, so there's no getting away from it.
It wasn't even this season. It was the end of last season when our heroes are on the road, and they're in an RV, oddly enough, talking about Race with the Devil.
Nice.
And they keep getting blocked off at various points by this seemingly massive, like, endless gang of men. And ultimately they have to sort of take a shortcut through the woods, and they're carrying a pregnant woman on a stretcher, and they're in complete darkness. And then all of a sudden you hear whistling, and then more whistling. And then all of a sudden, like, 12 people are whistling this weird, creepy tune. And then the next thing you know, like, all of these lights turn on, and they realize they're in the middle of a massive, massive group of people encircling them. And there's something about that idea, and there's something about a cult. There's something about a massive group of people essentially operating as one that scares the hell out of me.
Yeah.
And Kill List certainly does that. I mean, the moment you see all of those nude cultists with the wooden masks carrying torches and just walking through the forest, like, at that point, I'm about out at that point.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I want no more of that movie. But my God, after they execute the MP and Gall and Jay race away, and all the cultists are racing after them, and there's that horrible high-pitched screaming sound.
Yeah, almost like inhuman, almost animal. Like,
yeah, yeah. like an animal screeching or something. Like, I nearly pissed myself, I admit it freely.
I love it. And I think, and to connect with Race with the Devil, I think what works so well about that movie and this movie is that Race with the Devil is another cross-genre picture. Like, it's got, you know, it's got Peter Fonda in it.
Yeah,
and it's got
totally.
It's got this idea that it's kind of a swashbuckler. And then that ending is so scary because we're used to seeing these people win. And in these kinds of movies, like this kind of crime story or the, like the kind of mob picture, the hitman picture, you're used to seeing things unravel in a different way. You're used to having a double cross, or you're used to having, like, you know, the one last job gone wrong. And none of those cliches apply here. So when the other foot drops, kind of like in Race with the Devil, when the other foot drops and they're, you know, the RV is surrounded by the torches, like, it comes as such a surprise because we're so used to the train derailing in a different way in these kind of other genres that we're playing with. And I don't know. That's part of why the movie works so well for me, is that idea that, like, you know, maybe it is hitting genre boxes. Maybe it is playing with genre tropes, but they're the wrong genres for the movie we started off in.
Oh, totally.
And I think that's what makes the sucker punch land a little better.
Well, and how scary is it, too, that these two guys, I mean, they, you know, they have machine guns. They're well-trained. They're well-armed.
These guys have rocks. Yeah.
They have, like, rocks and knives, and that's it. And yet they still can't win because there's so damn many of them. I mean, there's something – it's almost like the characters themselves are holding on to the genre they're meant to exist with their, like, you know, fingernails. It's like, you know, they're blasting their machine guns. This is their hero's moment, you know, when they kill the bad guys, and they can't fucking do it.
Well, they can't do it because of the absolute disregard that the cultist has for their own lives. Like, they're, you know, all their, like, army training, all their hitman training doesn't mean anything when someone's running at you down a straight hallway and they don't care if they get shot or not. Do you know what I mean? Like, they just have that kind of ant hive mentality.
It's horrifying. The same thing with the two guys that they offed at the very beginning, the priest and the librarian. You know, not only are they able to give up their lives, but they're willing to thank the people who are ending their lives for having done it, you know. And
Yeah.
When the hammer scene works.
Yeah, the hammer scene, he gets so enraged because the guy's so calm.
Yeah, like, even for beating his knee, he only resorts
to the hammer once Gal leaves the room and the guy starts talking to him like he's, you know, the Messiah. And that's what throws Jay off. Jay's like, I'm not your goddamn Messiah. Like, would the Messiah do this? Like, and then breaks his hand open with a ball peen hammer, you know, like, it's great. Oh, it's so good.
Yeah. And even the end, you know, when they first approach the cult with the MP standing, you know, in the, you know, they have a girl who, you know, you expect it to be like a typical sacrifice. Like they're going to tie her down and do terrible things, but no, she calmly walks up to the noose. She puts it around her neck and then she hangs, and as she's struggling, there's that awful, awful sort of dispassionate golf clap that,
yeah, yeah,
you know, it's just awful and so, so fucking terrifying. And that's why I think the movie is one of the best horror movies, but it's one of those things, it's like, it's hard to sell the movie to horror fans because it doesn't look like a horror movie. It doesn't act like a horror movie. There's nothing about it that seems horror movie. And the only way you could get somebody who's, you know, a full-on genre fan to enjoy the movie is to spoil the final third for them, which you don't want to do. I remember when the movie came out, I had to review it for Dread Central, and I had to open my review by saying, look, it's a great movie, but I can't tell you why.
And I think the, you know, the marketing department at I think it's IFC Films put it out when they put it out in theaters. I feel like I hadn't seen a trailer. I saw it in the theaters. I saw it in Boston at the Brattle Theater. The marketing department had put on the poster, The Wicker Man meets The Professional. What did they put? They put something. So they ruined both genres that the movie's playing with, like, in one line. And I kind of like, it, you know, like, yeah, I'm sure that got butts in seats. Like, I'm sure it got my butt in a seat, but like, don't. Like, I wish I didn't know that going in. Like,
it's such a tough battle in a way, man. And I gotta, you know, as much as we like to knock marketing people, I mean, you know, their job is to make certain that people see the movie. I get that.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, would I have seen Kill List if I hadn't known it was a horror movie or a crime movie? Because I love both of those genres. You know, if you just show me a picture of, you know, Neil Maskell and the title Kill List, I don't know that I would have, you know, immediately sought it out. But, you know, on the basis of the reviews and having seen the trailer, which gave a little too much away, you know, I was like, damn, I need to see that movie. And it's still surprising. Like, it was still, you know, a bit of a jaw dropper.
Yeah, it's not gonna, I went in a little cleaner, like, I hadn't seen the trailer, but again, just knowing even that things are gonna go Wicker Man-y, like, kinda hurts a little bit. But it's still, I mean, it's one of those things, like, it's still a good movie when I watched it last night, you know, and I've seen it a bunch of times. Like, it's not the mark of a truly great film, because there are some great films that don't really stand up to a rewatch. They kind of work on you on such a visceral level up front, but this is a movie that, like, it's got that undeniable power if you can watch it and still be entertained. And I think that just goes to all that mix of genres. And as oppressive as it is, and as dread and filled, and as, you know, nerve shredding, I think was the word you used, as it is, the lightness to it, and the comedy, and the relationship between Gal and Jay is really kind of a big part of what brings me back to it, because it is so kind of weirdly sweet.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a good deal of heart in the movie. Like, you know, their relationship, like Jay and Shell, like, even though they're at each other's throats, I mean, the few moments in the movie they get together where they're not fighting are, like, kind of sweet in a way. Yeah. And, you know, like his relationship with his son, his relationship with Gall even is great. You know, I feel like there's probably a great buddy comedy to be made with those same two characters, you know?
Yeah.
And it gives the movie a little more, I think, a little more weight. And it goes back to the fact that, like, Wheatley does so well, and Amy Jump, they both do so well with packing all of that detail in, all of that character work, all of those tonal shifts into, like, a lean hour and a half. I mean, it's kind of amazing in a way.
Yeah, it's something that, watching it with a critical eye, like watching it with a pen and paper, I mean, this is the first time I did watch it and take notes. I like, just little things just kind of kept blowing me away about it, like how lean it is. Like, there really is, there's no fat on it, even though it's usually on a lot of lesser horror filmmakers, I feel like mistake mood. They try to inject mood at the cost of pace.
Yeah.
And this is a film that you don't need, langorious shots of the woods to kind of have that final scare at the end of being in the woods. Like it's a movie that establishes a tone and mood very effortlessly. And while it's doing other things,
Oh, totally. Like, you were talking about A Shot of the Woods. I mean, I think the best illustration of your point that I can think of is that great shot where, the music is droning and we do get a shot of the woods, but you know what? Jay is emerging from them and he looks wrecked. You know, he's just lost his friend. He's pissed. And we hold on him, and it sort of does two things at once. There is atmosphere there. It does set a tone, and yet, the movie is also getting its work done too.
Yeah. Yep. No, I 100% agree. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's funny too. Looking at it, you mentioned that the titles do not really come at act breaks, and I was thinking of it. It is like three movies in one. It's a drama, it's a crime flick, it's a horror movie, and yet, watching it again last night, it's not like they're a clean, typical, Sid Field act breaks in this film.
No,
exactly.
No.
Like, it takes much more of like a, how do I want to say this? It feels kind of like a not, what it reminded me of when I first watched it? It reminded me of picking up like some random leisure paperback novel from like 10 years ago where you could start on page one and think you know where the story is going, and then by the end it might be something completely different. There was a surprise to it.
And I think that's something, I think that's something horror authors are a lot more apt to do, especially when you have a bigger canvas. They will mix genres more.
And it's so much better when they do.
Subplots,
Horror should keep you, I think, a little, you shouldn't be on sure footing. Like, you shouldn't know instinctively when the act breaks are going to be. You shouldn't know what's coming. And I feel like watching Kill List, it gave me that same sort of feeling as reading kind of like a horror novel written by a daring author,
Yeah, no, I think that's sometimes a bad thing, that kind of, that's sometimes what people kind of conflate with like, hack writing or kind of seat of the pants writing. But I think when it's this deliberate, and when the person has really thought about structure and really thought about, blending different elements and really like, you're grafting a Frankenstein's monster, but you're doing your best, with your Marie Claire makeup, at the end to kind of hide the stitch marks. And I think that's, I don't know. I think that leads to the best genre work to me. For me. And that's, not to say that I'm like 100%, and not to get self-promotional, but not to say that I'm 100% all like influenced by this film, but like there are definitely certainly works that I've worked on that I'm like, if Ben Wheatley were doing this, or if Amy Jump were doing this, like what would they, how would they handle this? And what would they cut out? And I think that's a big part of it, because a lot of it exists in between these cuts. Like a lot of very important things happen where they're either conversations take place or, people are meeting that we don't see meet. Like it has to, just for this story to work. And our mind kind of goes back and subconsciously fills in the blanks, because nothing's boring us ever in this movie. And that's how it's influential to me. And that's how I like to look at it and admire it, because it's like the idea of like a good marble, sculptor. Like you leave just exactly the amount of marble you need in any given area, and it makes this kind of perfect looking thing.
All right. I can't think of a better way to leave off than that, actually. So I think that's about our time. Thank you so much for being on the show and for choosing Kill List to talk about. Can I ask, where can folks find you at online? I know you mentioned, I should have mentioned it during your introduction. I forgot all about the Cemetery Dance column, but, can I ask where can folks find you online, and, what can they keep an eye out for from you in the future?
They can just type in adamcaesar.com. That'll bring them to my website. If they type in my name, Adam Caesar, AdamCaesare. I know it sounds like the salad and it's spelled like Cesare, but that's just something we have to deal with. If they just, do any of that, Google me, it'll bring them to my blog. It'll bring them to my books on Amazon. And I guess, like, I don't really have all that much coming up. I'm about to do a reading tomorrow, but I feel like we won't be hearing that in time. My newest book is The Con Season. It is a showbiz slasher satire about a group of celebrities that think they're going to the hottest, newest interactive fan convention, only to get to the woods of Kentucky and realize that the fans have all paid money to see them be killed in a real life slasher film.
That's a brilliant idea too. Like, I'm a huge convention goer, and every time I go to one, I see all these horror fans, you know, sort of stalking about, some of them looking, you know, kind of scary, kind of terrifying. Some of them, you know, like fully embracing the genre. And, you know, you see so many horror stars and, you know, people who portrayed heroes in horror movies or villains at times or whatever. And I'm like, how the hell has nobody set a movie like a horror movie at a horror convention? Why is that something that hasn't happened yet? So I love the sound of this book. I think it sounds fantastic.
Yeah, no. And if people want to, if any of the people, producers, directors listening want to option that, they can get in touch with me too. So.
That movie needs to be made.
Yeah, no, I'd love that. I'd love the paycheck. So I can keep writing my weird little books. So.
All right. Well, sir, thank you again so much. I really appreciate your time.
No, thank you, Jinx. This was a great discussion. Thanks for letting me choose the movie.
All right, and thanks to you listeners out there. As always, please be sure to like, subscribe, share, maybe write us in the comments section below, or leave us an iTunes review. Check out our YouTube show. If we get enough views, we'll possibly make some more someday. Be sure to purchase Kill List and Mr. Caesar's books using the Amazon links below. And remember, any purchase you make through our Amazon links will keep this podcast going. So thanks for that. Also, find that Audible deal on our site. If you sign up for a free 30-day trial, you get 2 free books. Until next time, gang, thanks so much, and have a great weekend.